According to Tammy Mall's book, A Convenient Suspect, when it was time to deliver closing arguments, Patty's attorney, Jim Burke, was white-faced and visibly unnerved. It was possible that given the weight of the DNA evidence, he saw the writing on the wall. But it was his job to create reasonable doubt, and so he attempted to do just that. He acknowledged the pressure the police were under and the sentiments of the family and the public, and that it was important to find justice for the victims. He reminded the jury that no one saw Patty's van in Pennsylvania or along any of the routes to Pennsylvania. In fact, no one had testified that she ever left North Carolina. He stressed that Joe's car showed no signs of struggle, soil, or blood. If Patty had gotten into that car with Joe, why were there no signs that anything happened in that car? If Patty was so obsessed with Andy that she would murder his entire family, why didn't she make a move for him after the murders if this was indeed a case of fatal attraction? Burke reminded the jury that the state said it wasn't a robbery, but Joe's purse was missing. And there was no way to know if there had been a sexual assault because the evidence would have been degraded by the time the bodies were found. The phone line that was cut in the Katranach home was in the farthest, darkest corner of the basement. How would Patty even know where it was? Burke pointed out that the state put Patty's mom on trial too, impugning her reputation because they didn't have any evidence against Patty. He harshly criticized how the forensic evidence was handled with bare hands, without proper labeling. And he emphasized the state failed to test hair in the victim's hand. Not only that, the police were still taking hair samples from others up until 2 months before trial. And finally, he brought home the point that everything the prosecution alleged about Patty was true for Andy, too. Just like him, all of her alibis were family and friends. Except, that's not true, because of Leroy Rouse. Remember, Rouse was the guy who sold grain to Patty, and he was one of the people she swore she saw in North Carolina on the day that Joe and Alex disappeared. But the jury never heard from Rouse, and when you find out why, what happened in this case will become even clearer. Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed. I'm Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author, and I'm here with my colleague, Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm a professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. It was 4:30 p.m. on Friday, March 4th, 1998, at the Lehigh County Courthouse. The jury had begun deliberations that morning and returned a verdict within hours, which meant everyone had to return to the courthouse to hear it. In my experience, deliberations beginning on a Friday is always a bad stroke of luck. Jurors are itching to get the weekend to themselves and have less incentive to deliberate as long as they should. According to the Morning Call newspaper, the room was packed, the perimeter surrounded by a dozen police officers. Andy Katranach, in a display of grief, sat clutching a chain to his lips. The chain had Joe's wedding ring on it, and he had worn it like this since the medical examiner's office had returned it to him 3 years earlier. Patty returned to the courtroom, already in tears. Anxious and jittery, she took a seat next to her lawyers. The judge asked the foreman to rise and deliver the verdict. Guilty, he announced, of murder in the first degree. Sobs broke out in the room, some from Patty, some from Joe's family. Patty turned around in her seat, trying to scan the packed room for her own family, but instead ended up looking at a trial spectator dead in the eye. They stared at each other, and Patty silently mouthed, "I didn't do this to the woman." And the woman nodded and responded back, "I know." There was no way in that moment for Patty to know that this court spectator was going to take the torch from her own mother as Patty's biggest advocate for many years to come.
So Margaret was a woman who actually sat through the whole trial. And after sitting through the trial, she actually believed that Patty was wrongfully convicted.
That's Tammy Mall again, and she's referring to Margaret Sneary, the woman who locked eyes with Patty and assured her that she knew she was innocent as soon as the verdict was read.
And she got very close to Patty and very involved in the case. She did a lot of research on her own. She was actually a journalist. She wrote for a local paper down there, and that's how she went to the trial. She was covering it for the paper.
The work that Margaret Sneary did investigating this case and uncovering evidence that was buried by the authorities was and continues to be pivotal to understanding how Patty was railroaded. Margaret didn't just collect the case files and records, she launched her own investigation.
Yes, that was when Margaret went to North Carolina, and she interviewed several people down there. Fonda Eggers, who, you know, she took a statement from. And Fonda, of course, told her that Patty was under surveillance during the exact time the Pennsylvania State Police claimed she was in Pennsylvania stalking and then murdering Joanne and Alex. And Fonda had told Margaret that they documented the surveillance, and she had given those surveillance notes to one of the troopers, and no one has ever seen those notes again.
To refresh her memory, Fonda Eggers was the woman, that distant relative of Patty's, who had been tasked to investigate animal abuse charges against her. Eggers was at the hearing on December 12, 1994, where Patty was told to keep receipts of grain that she bought for her horses to show authorities upon demand. Eggers had testified at trial, but only about her investigation. She never testified about the surveillance she says she did for that entire week. Remember, Eggers had it out for Patty. She was even told by the judge to stay away from Patty, but she just couldn't keep herself away. She told Margaret that the week of the murders, she and others had surveyed Patty in hopes of finding evidence of animal abuse that would get her slapped with something more serious than just having to prove that she bought horse grain. Eggers had taken notes, documenting Patty's every move, and she had turned those notes over to Detective Tony Roberson of the Davidson County, North Carolina Sheriff's Office, back when she had been interviewed by the police when they were still investigating Patty as a suspect. The notes have since disappeared. As far as anyone knows, they were never turned over to the defense. Patty never knew about them. And frankly, right now, the state won't allow anybody to look at their files. But there are only so many possibilities with these notes. That Roberson himself buried them, or he turned them over to the Pennsylvania State Police and they buried them, or the Pennsylvania State Police turned them over to the prosecutors and they buried them. Whatever happened to them, we can be sure that they hurt the state's case. Because if they helped the state's case, well, not only would we have a copy of them, but Eggers would have been asked about her surveillance on the stand. Eggers would have been a perfect state witness to prove that Patty had left North Carolina. In my opinion, these notes are likely key to proving that Patty, in fact, never left North Carolina the week that Joe and Alex were killed. And that is why the state made them disappear. One of the biggest growth hacks is realizing that you don't have to do it all by yourself. And if you have a business, Upwork makes it easy to bring in the right freelancer when you need them, so you can stay focused on what you do best. Upwork is a one-stop platform to find, hire, and pay expert freelancers across web and software development, data and analytics, marketing, business operations, and more. Upwork helps grow your business by giving you fast access to specialized talent across 125 plus categories, so you can fill skill gaps, launch projects faster, and scale support up or down without committing to a full-time headcount. You can browse profiles, review past work, and get help scoping the role so you can hire with confidence and get started quickly. With Business Plus, you can access the top 1% of talent on Upwork, and with AI-powered shortlisting, you'll get matched to the right freelancer in under 6 hours. No endless searching required. Upwork also cuts down operational hassle by handling things like contracts and payments in one place, so you can spend more time running the business. Thousands of growing businesses already trust Upwork to hire flexible, high-quality freelance talent for everything from one-off projects to ongoing support. It is free to sign up, and posting a job is easy. Visit Upwork.com right now and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's UPWORK.com, Upwork.com.
Margaret was also instrumental in discovering why Leroy Rouse, the one fairly solid alibi that Patty had, who is neither a friend or a relative, didn't show up for trial.
And Margaret also interviewed Leroy Rouse, who was Patty's grain dealer. And she got information from him about, first of all, about when Patty came for grain, which he said was Thursdays and Saturdays, and that she had been there the week before Christmas, which if she had gone on Thursday would have been December the 15th.
Rouse was someone who Patty mentioned to the police in every single official interview she gave then, hoping they would go verify her alibi before things got out of hand. During the investigation, Rouse corroborated what Patty said to the police, but then, come time of the trial, he didn't show up.
According to Margaret, when she interviewed Leroy Rouse, he told her that he planned to testify and he was prepared to testify until a North Carolina officer came and told him he wasn't needed and he didn't have to testify. And that was not true. Patty and her attorneys were waiting for him to come. In fact, you know, the Judge Wallach asked about him, and Patty's attorney said, "We don't know where he is. We heard he may have had a death in the family."
Except there was no death in the family. According to Leroy Rouse, he was not only able and willing to testify, he'd been waiting to be contacted by the state or the defense, or really anyone, to arrange to go to the trial. When Margaret interviewed Leroy on April 29th, 2002, this is what he told her. Detective Tony Roberson had visited him at his house on a Friday night and asked him to sign some papers that would, quote, release him from testifying. Rouse refused to sign the papers and sent Roberson packing, but then he kept waiting, and no one contacted him.
So he never testified, and according to him, it was because some police officer lied to him.
And no, again, there was no death in Rouse's family back in March of 1998. He had no idea the defense team had been lied to and told that because Rouse had a death in the family, he would not be able to testify at trial. On both ends, the state made sure that Patty could not get a fair trial, that she would be deprived of the testimony that could have saved her life in a case where the state was seeking to put her to death.
Margaret Sneary was also responsible for another huge discovery in the case, the memo written by Pennsylvania State Trooper Robert Egan, in which he describes a man who is such a nuisance that he had to throw him out of the barracks, Walter Trotman. Trotman was a witness who saw an altercation between a couple on the afternoon of December 15, 1994, and he believed that couple was Andy and Joe Katranak. He reported that altercation the same day, and later he tried desperately to get the police's attention to take his statement seriously. He visited the barracks three or four times, speaking to different officers, and none of them took a written statement, as far as we know. He wrote a letter, drew a picture of the man he saw, and Trooper Egan destroyed them both. Well, no one knew that Trotman even existed until years after the trial, when Margaret got a copy of Egan's one and only memo through a public records request. Not only that, she managed to identify Trotman, even though Egan's memo misspelled his name dozens of times and even misrepresented his age by over a decade.
Margaret discovered that and then went to Craig Neely. She knew Craig Neely. And when he saw that, you know, then he ended up coming on to Patty's case as well.
If you have seen some of the media made about the case, you may be familiar with Craig Neely. He's been interviewed about the case, including on a Dateline special with Keith Morrison. Neely was Patty's post-conviction attorney who believed as hard as Margaret believed that Patty was completely innocent, which is why he took it on pro bono. With the Trotman evidence in hand, Neely went back to court.
So the appeal was on the Walter Trotman statement. They went in as a Brady violation, which is when the prosecution doesn't hand over exculpatory evidence to the defense. And they also, at that point, asked for DNA testing. What they wanted DNA tested at that time was the fingernail that had been found on her chest. And Judge Ford, who heard the appeal, he had Trooper Egan verify that that fingernail and all the evidence was intact and available for testing, which Trooper Egan said it was. And then Judge Ford issued an order stating that, you know, that evidence is not to be tainted with in any way.
The reason Neely wanted that particular fingernail to be tested was because it was a near-perfect forensic specimen found in a highly probative place. It wasn't a partial nail fragment. It was the entire front end torn off, and it clearly had fleshy, bloody material still attached to it. We even have pictures of it. And of course, it was found on the victim's chest, which meant it had to belong to the killer.
Well, when the fingernail got to the lab, which was Orchid Cellmark, they told them they couldn't test it because the nail had been cleaned. There was nothing left on it to test. And no one has any idea who cleaned that nail off, when it was done, why it was done. When Judge Ford had Trooper Egan check, Trooper Egan said that the evidence was intact and available for testing. So you tell me.
The fingernail was useless now. Perhaps the best piece of forensic evidence had been thoroughly cleaned of all genetic material of that fleshy, bloody mass and then sent to the lab by the state, despite being ordered by the court to preserve it. Neely wasn't giving up, though. He petitioned the court for more testing.
Patty wanted to then test the cigarette butt, and Craig Neely wanted to test one of the seatback hairs that supposedly had been mounted immediately after they were found, or, you know, had never been looked at, you know, that they were mounted under glass. And right. Patty told Craig, she said, I don't want to test the hair. I don't trust it. They already supposedly matched it to me. I didn't do this crime. That couldn't have been my hair in the car. But Craig said, no. Let's do the hair. The mounted hair. Patty wanted to do the cigarette. So the cigarette butt was found with the bodies. I mean, right with the bodies. And that has never been tested, which I find absolutely ridiculous, because just about any lab will tell you that a cigarette butt is one of the richest sources for DNA testing. But that was never tested. And Patty wanted to have that tested because Patty has never smoked. And as far as she knows, neither Joanne nor Andy smoked either. So whose cigarette butt was that?
But there was another piece of evidence that I certainly thought was the most probative of all the hair evidence. The hair clutched in Joe's right hand. Why didn't they request testing on that?
They did ask to test the hair in the hand. And their request was denied because Judge Wallace had ruled that it's called law of the case. And the way I understand it is, since the jury knew about the hair and knew it had not been tested, in the court's opinion, it would not change the verdict in any way. So he would not allow them to test that hair in the hand.
This episode is brought to you by Alloy Health. On Undisclosed, stories often show how hard it is to get the right help when you need it. Menopause can feel the same way. Almost half of women wait 3 or more years before finding relief from symptoms like hot flashes, sleepless nights, and brain fog. Many try to get answers from their doctor, only to be told it's normal or feel rushed through an appointment. Alloy was built by women who have been there. It connects you with menopause-specialized doctors and proven treatments, all from home. Care can start in hours, not weeks. Join the 95% of women who tried Alloy and saw relief in the first 2 weeks. Head to myalloy.com and use the code SUMMER20. Your menopause-specialized doctor will tailor your treatment to your exact needs. Plus, you get unlimited messaging with your doctor. Head to myalloy.com and use code SUMMER20 to get $20 off.
So, what is the law of the case? It's a doctrine in Pennsylvania and other jurisdictions, specifically a legal principle that mandates judges adhere to prior rulings made on legal issues throughout the different stages of the same lawsuit. It promotes judicial efficiency and finality by preventing the relitigation of issues that have already been decided. But here's the thing. It's actually of a family of three related rules articulated in the leading case, Commonwealth versus Starr, and it applies in three cases. One, upon remand, the trial court must strictly comply with the appellate court's mandate and may not alter its resolution of a legal question that was previously decided on appeal. Two, an appellate court may not alter the resolution of a legal question that was previously decided by the same appellate court in a prior appeal in the same case. And three, the coordinate jurisdiction rule. Judges of coordinate jurisdiction in the same case should not overrule each other's decisions. In other words, a second trial judge should not revisit another judge's suppression ruling. It doesn't seem as if any of these instances apply in Patty's case, but even more importantly, it's a discretionary doctrine that a court does not have to apply. In this case, though, it did, and here's the ridiculous reason why. Because the state had already stipulated at trial that the hair was not Patty's. Let me repeat that. The state had stipulated, agreed, admitted at trial that the hair in Joe's hand was not Patty's, and that's the reason the court denied testing it. The reasoning being, well, the jury already knew that the hair in Joe's hand wasn't Patty's, so it wouldn't have changed the verdict they had reached while already knowing it.
I've seen so many variations of prosecutors subverting DNA testing that I shouldn't be shocked, but I always am. Because forget what verdict the jury would have reached. Doesn't the state, the police, the prosecutors, the courts, don't they all want to know who the hair belongs to? The prosecutor, by the way, was asked in that same Dateline special with Keith Morris about opposing testing that particular hair.
Why wasn't it tested?
It was looked at, and it was already determined that it wasn't Joanne's and it wasn't Patricia's. Who cares whose it is?
Killers.
But so, you mean the other killer, because Roar's two hairs are out there in the debris too. You know, the raid hairs, six in the car, two found on the debris. So there was somebody with Patricia Roar? Okay.
Well, I bet.
Does that make her not guilty?
Why not test the hair?
Because they had hairs from the crime scene.
Yeah, but
you
come
know
on.
What, Keith?
The hair closes.
Have you looked at? Did you ever see one where somebody didn't say, you could have done this? You know, you could have also done this. You're right. You got me. We should have tested it.
My rage over this is only tempered by my cynicism, knowing that there was already misconduct when it came to the hair evidence. If the judge had allowed testing that hair, I'm with Patty. I'd worry that they would switch the hair in Joe's hand, too.
It's not her hair, it's in the victim's hand, but she's not allowed to test it, and it's never been tested. That is what bothers me so bad, you know? It's what wasn't tested is not insignificant. It's a hair in the hand that doesn't belong to the woman convicted of killing them. It's fingernail fragments that, according to Dr. Jensen of the Pennsylvania State Police Lab, was too big to be either Patty's or Joanne's. Who left this forensic evidence right on the bodies?
Despite Patty's nervousness about asking for further DNA testing of the mounted hairs, Neely went forward with the request. And that sealed Patty's fate in a way that only she had foreseen.
It turned out to be an incredibly perfect match to Patty. It was like one in 10 sextillion that it was her hair.
You heard that right. After all those years, after fighting to get more DNA testing, the result of testing that slide was that the hair within it was an absolute perfect match for Patty. This was not a case of she cannot be excluded. This was an exact match. Imagine the shock and grief this brought not just to Patty, but to her supporters, to Margaret Sneary, her staunch advocate, to Craig Neely, her lawyer who believed in her innocence. It was such a shock to Neely, in fact, that for years he walked away from the case. And this was exactly what Patty had been afraid of, given her certainty and the evidence that her hair had been switched with the Q1 loose hairs collected from the car years earlier. This time, though, the hair that had been submitted to the independent lab were the Q4, Q5, and Q6 hairs. Those were the three hairs taken from the car that were mounted on slides by Dr. Jensen, the same slides that the FBI lab had returned back to him in 1995, before the hair from Patty's head had even been collected, because, according to the FBI, despite all attempts to break into them, they were unable to unseal the slides. Magically, though, in 2008, this independent lab was able to pry open the Q5 slide, and lo and behold, they found a root on it. And the DNA on that root matched Patty without question. I can only imagine what this time was like for Patty, who had a feeling all along that this could go badly, and how this seemed very much like the end of the appellate road for her. What on earth could overcome a perfect DNA match taken from forensic evidence inside a sealed slide?
As airtight as the DNA results seem to be, this round of testing raises even more questions about the hairs themselves. First of all, the independent lab, called Cellmark Orchid, also tested the shaft of the Q4 hair and found nothing. What they should have found was Dr. Jensen's DNA, because recall that this was one of the hairs that he had handled with his bare hands back in 1995. Next, in 1998, Dr. Jensen testified first that when these same slides were returned to him from the FBI, one was cracked because they tried to get into it. Now, whether or not they get into the slide depends upon whether you believe the FBI or whether you believe Jensen. And second, Dr. Jensen testified that some of the hairs inside the slides were also broken. But in 2008, Cellmark Orchid tested the hair inside the exact same three slides and reported that all three hairs and slides were intact. But if ever there were a smoking gun that the hair collected from the car was switched with the hair taken from Patty's head, when Cellmark Orchid received the evidence to be tested, they created an inventory of it. The Q4 hair entry reads, "Slide appears to have one long, light brown hair, which does not appear to have a root. Hair does appear to get lighter toward the end." The Q5 hair entry reads, "Slide appears to have one long, light brown hair with a small root. Hair does appear to get lighter toward one end." The Q6 hair entry reads, "Slide appears to have one long light brown/brown hair, which does not appear to have a root." All three of these slides had mounted hairs, the ones allegedly collected from the car, the ones described as dirty blonde in all the initial reports, and described in this inventory as light brown or brown. And two of these hairs are described as being lighter on one end. Now, critically, referring back to Patty's photo from December 1994, when she had bleached, permed hair, if she had left her hair at the crime scene, it would likely be described as blonde or dirty blonde, and darker on one end because of her dark roots. But these hairs were described as brown, with two of them being lighter on one end. Does that ring a bell? It should. In last week's addendum, you heard Dr. Joseph DeZinno describe Patty's hair simple, the one pulled from her head in November 1995, as being dyed, but that the quarter of the hair found by the root looked like the hair found in the car. Remember, she had brown hair by then, so in other words, he's saying that by the time they collected her hair sample, she had dyed her hair brown, but a quarter of the hair by the root looked dirty blonde. Brown but lighter on one end. That is exactly the description of the hair taken from Patty's head, as well as the hair that Cellmark Orchid pried out of the Q4, Q5, Q5, and Q6 slides. And if that, along with Dr. Thomas Jensen's weird trial testimony about hair that he remounted, doesn't convince you that the authorities switched Patty's hair, the evidence doesn't end there.
Margaret Sneary continued to work on the case, still convinced that Patty was innocent, despite the new DNA finding. She worked on the case until the very end.
She did. She worked on it from the time of trial, right in, up until the day she died. She was still working on it there. And, you know, like, I owe a big debt to Margaret. I never met her. But, you know, she did a lot of work and a lot of research. And that was invaluable to me.
Margaret Sneary died on June 24th, 2011. She was only 61 years old. She had spent the last 13 years of her life devoted to exonerating Patty. And without her, we would never have been able to piece together all the ways the state denied Patty justice. By the time Margaret passed away, so had Patty's mother and stepfather. Her fiancé had decided he no longer wanted Patty to have any access to their daughter, the daughter who was only 15 months old when Patty was arrested. It must have been the darkest time ever for Patty. But a year after Margaret died, another helper entered her life, one who picked up where Margaret left off. That helper, that advocate, is Tammy Mell. You've already heard how Tammy got involved in the case and how she first got to know Patty. She had heard about the case for years, it was nearly unavoidable news in their region, and decided to write her next true crime book about it. Her communications with Patty and her review of the record and evidence left her convinced that Patty had nothing to do with the murders of Joe and Alex. Unfortunately, though, Team Patty was facing the reality of the 2008 DNA test.
That's the nail in the coffin. She would never again have any of her appeals, even in my opinion, looked at, because they see this perfect DNA match, and it's like, this woman is guilty. That's how they feel. That's how they treat her. That's why she gets appeals that are denied the day the court receives them. I'm sorry, how do you read carefully an appeal and look at the evidence when you're denying it within hours of receiving it? No one has, and every single court in denying her appeals has mentioned that DNA match. Every single one. There's not one denial she has gotten that does not mention that DNA, has linked her to the crime.
Even nails in a coffin can be removed, though, and that is what Tammy set out to do. She started filing public information request after public information request.
I filed to the Pennsylvania State Police, to the Catasauqua Police, and to the FBI FOIA requests. And I got nothing from the Pennsylvania State Police. They told me that because there was a minor involved, they wouldn't release anything. And the Caddy Police told me that they had moved offices and they simply couldn't find anything from this case at all, nothing. And then it took two to three years before I got a response from the FBI. And at that point, they sent me a disc, which contained about 350 pages of reports and notes and everything.
Buried in the jumbled, out-of-order documents that had been scanned to the disk so that every single page was saved as a different document, was a notation that Tammy couldn't believe she was seeing.
And it was in there that I found one that said, the car seat hairs have no roots attached.
This episode is brought to you by Alloy Health. On Undisclosed, stories often show how hard it is to get the right help when you need it. Menopause can feel the same way. Almost half of women wait 3 or more years before finding relief from symptoms like hot flashes, sleepless nights, and brain fog. Many try to get answers from their doctor, only to be told it's normal or feel rushed through an appointment. Alloy was built by women who have been there. It connects you with menopause-specialized doctors and proven treatments, all from home. Care can start in hours, not weeks. Join the 95% of women who tried Alloy and saw relief in the first 2 weeks. Head to myalloy.com and use the code SUMMER20. Your menopause-specialized doctor will tailor your treatment to your exact needs. Plus, you get unlimited messaging with your doctor. Head to myalloy.com and use code SUMMER20 to get $20 off.
Whether or not any of the hair evidence taken from the car in the crime scene, those mounted and unmounted hairs known as the Q1 through Q6 samples, had roots or not, has been one of the most significant issues in this case. None of the original Pennsylvania State Lab and FBI lab reports describing the evidence ever mention a root, and neither of the labs did any nuclear DNA testing of the hairs in the beginning before Patty's hair samples were plucked from her head. Given these two facts, we infer that this must mean that none of the hairs in evidence had roots, which is why the 2008 DNA test that had found a root and matched to Patty perfectly was such a surprise. But now, years later, Tammy had discovered an FBI memo written on July 25th, 1995, 3 months after Joe and Alex's bodies were found. Here's how it describes the evidence collected in the car. Number 10, victim's vehicle. Dirt in undercarriage and on floor of back seat and floor in driver's position. PSP believes vehicle used to transport victims to remote disposal location. It is believed abductor sat in rear seat behind Joanne, driver, as car seat, Alex, on passenger side of front seat. Vehicle discovered at 2 a.m., 12/16/94, in parking lot 150 yards south of Katronach residence. Subsection A. Found in car on driver's headrest, 3 hairs, 9 inches long, no roots attached, and blood on 2 of the 3. PSP lab reported hair not that of victims. Presently, at FBI lab for DNA analysis, exemplars of, redacted in Rohrer copy, blood and hair will be secured and sent to lab for comparison. This is the first document ever seen by the defense that affirmatively and conclusively states that the hair collected did not have roots. And this document was never turned over to the defense.
So, you know, that was never handed over to the defense. The defense never saw that report. But the big question is, if those seatback hairs had no roots, what hair root was tested and matched to Patty? It couldn't have been one of the car seat hairs.
Based on this newly discovered evidence, Patty went back to court again.
She did file an appeal based on that. And there was a hearing, but only a hearing to inspect and copy documents, because it was at that point that we realized also that the one Catasauqua officer we never had the second page to his report. So that was what the hearing was for. The judge wouldn't allow me to testify about what I had found. He wouldn't allow anybody to take the stand there. And then he just denied the appeal on saying that Patty could have found that report anytime she wanted to. Basically a denial on due diligence.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry.
Let me just say goodnight to this.
No problem.
Oh, thank you, Ralph. Ralph, can I get back to you a little bit? Do your hearing aid fix. Can I get back to you a little bit? No, I don't want to touch you a little bit, no. I'll get back to you a little bit. Yeah, yes. No, I have some people here. I'll get back to you.
That is the voice of private investigator Joe Alersha, straight out of Central Casting. And the people he had there with him were me and Jennifer Leahy, our researcher and investigative assistant on this case.
I'm doing a death case now where they screwed up there in Allentown. I'm all over the place. I just so many things, you know. Yeah. I got enough for 3 books and 5 movies.
Yeah,
I worked with John Gotti. Did you ever hear of John Gotti?
Oh, yeah.
I did work for one of his men, a lot of defense work.
Okay.
You know, defense work. I do a lot of defense, criminal defense work, stuff yeah. like that. So I've been around the block.
All in Pennsylvania, though?
Yeah. Well, okay. Yeah. Well, Jersey.
Oh, okay.
I'm licensed in New York.
Okay.
New Jersey, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
So I do a lot of this stuff. And the system screwed up. I don't know if you're for the system or against it, but I mean, I'm with the system, but the piss poor investigations that they do from the start.
Yeah.
If they could don't lie from the start, because one lie leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. We're about to get 2 guys out of prison now that have been in prison for 30, 40 years for something that they didn't do.
Yeah.
You know?
Joe was chatty and personable and surrounded by just hundreds of boxes and case files pouring out of every cabinet, covering every shelf and table surface, and piled up all over the floors of his labyrinth of an office, which occupies the entire basement level of a building.
Mary Sneary.
Margaret.
Margaret Sneary, okay?
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So she came on and she was, please, can you help me?
Yeah.
And me, so I'm always jammed up because I can never say no. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I got on there, and I seen a lot of flaws. And the way I work a case, I try to prove my client guilty.
Yeah.
The reverse.
Yeah.
Okay. So there was one point in the case where I told Margaret, I said, I want you to do a test run for me. I want you to go from North Carolina, where they said that she ran all the way to North Carolina. Well, we figured out she would have to do like 98 miles an hour, stop for no gas, stop for nothing, drives from there to there, kill the little baby, and then drive all the way back. You know? It was impossible. So, yeah. You know, so they didn't want to. And it all started, I'm going to jump.
Did Margaret do that drive?
Yeah, Margaret did that drive.
Oh, man, okay.
Margaret did that drive.
Yeah.
So and then the state police screwed up the lab with the hair and all that bullshit, right? I swear, so don't mind me.
No, it's fine.
The way that the police investigation was up at the house, there's a bunch of stuff that I proved. There's no way when he found hair in the car, well, he was dating a girl. You're going to find hair in the car. Mm-hmm. She would have had to go to the house, break it. It was all staged.
The girl he's referring to, by the way, is Terry Benchini, the former girlfriend of Andy's that took Joe's picture and jewelry to a psychic, the same woman he later married and moved to Colorado with, and who also happened to have long, dirty blonde hair. Like Margaret and alongside her, Joe spent years investigating the case. He spoke to witnesses, reviewed case files, visited the crime scenes, and dug into every aspect possible to try and find new evidence that could get Patty a new trial. At the end of it all, having turned over every nook and cranny, here is the conclusion he came to.
What's your theory of the crime? What happened to Joe?
I think the husband did it. Absolutely, way beyond a reasonable doubt. And we were insistent that he had something to do with it. Andy had something to do with it. Then he got remarried, and he moved out to, and then that wife got rid of him.
Colorado?
Yeah, Colorado.
Isn't that the same woman that he's with now?
No, he's not with Terry anymore.
Oh, he's not with Terry
anymore.
No. Yeah, that's another thing. The where the incident where the body was found wasn't far from where Terry lived.
Yeah, just a few miles.
Stuff like this.
Yeah.
So,
what do you think the motive was? Just he didn't want the kid? He didn't...
I don't think... He either thought that, you know, because she got pregnant by somebody else, or he didn't want the kid. I think he was, you know, leading up to with the girlfriend, what that was her name, the girlfriend. What was his girlfriend's name? I can't think. One lived up there where the baby was found.
Yeah.
Teresa.
Teresa.
Or Terry, yeah.
Terry, yeah. You know, he's just, that's what I think the motive was.
Margaret, Tammy, Joe, these are just 3 of the many people who have looked deeply into this case and found it to be an appalling travesty of justice. Numerous documentaries have been made about it. An advocacy group by the name of Judges for Justice not only spent years working on the case, They sent thousands of postcard flyers to Lehigh Valley residents to try and find new evidence. And they even created a YouTube series about it. Not hard to find, just look up Judges for Justice. The case eventually made its way to the Making an Exoneree Innocence program at Georgetown University, and from there, it made its way to Undisclosed.
So we spent the last 2 days at the courthouse going through the exhibits.
Right.
Because I mean, I would love to have access to the police investigative file, which they won't give
I don't know what I got back to. You want to go back and look?
Yeah, I'd love to go back and look. Let's go see.
Oh, don't get old. I'm 84 years old, still working.
Are you 84?
Yeah, watch your step.
You look amazing for 84.
I'm 84. My wife's like about 35 younger than me, 35 years younger.
Dang. Okay.
That's just,
that's keeping you young.
I'm going to go get the boxes. Just, you can pull that shit out of there.
Thank you.
I don't have anything to drink. I don't
No, no, we're good. We're good. It's a laughing. Yeah. Okay. Actually, let me get my notebook, too. You need some help? I can help you. Grab her.
My muscles are all weak from this freaking.
Over the 34 years of Patty's ordeal, helpers keep showing up. And that's a great sign. Because if there's one common thread between exonerations that I've seen, it's always this, that there is always someone, at least one person, that doesn't give up and that refuses to walk away. But another common thread is this, that the state also refuses to give up. Next time on Undisclosed. As we all know, there is always more to the story. So tune in every Thursday during this entire season where we're going to be dropping our addendum episodes. In those episodes, we will go deeper on some of the issues raised in that week's episode, and we're going to answer listener questions. And if you want even more Undisclosed content, remember, you can become a patron by signing up at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. And if you've got feedback for us, you can find us at speakpipe.com/undisclosed, where you can leave us an actual voice note. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at Undisclosed Pod. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Undisclosed Pod. And we've got our own little private Facebook group called the Toward Justice Community. All you gotta do is answer 3 quick questions and I will let you in. You can follow me, Rabia, on Instagram at Rabia2, the number 2. And you can follow Colin at Evidence Prof on X and Blue Sky. Follow the podcast on X at Undisclosed Pod. We want to thank our sponsors, and I want to thank our intrepid team, our sound editor, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Methil Thelhan, and my amazing investigator, Jennifer Leahy. And a very special thank you to true crime author and advocate, Tammy Mall, who made this season possible. Thank you, Tammy, for all your work.